From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young in Boston.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now. President Biden travels to the port of Baltimore today to send a message that the $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill that Congress passed last week will help prevent future disruptions to the supply chain.
Like that huge backlog of goods on container ships parked at ports in California. We've been looking at where else that infrastructure money might go. We've got three states today, starting with California, and KQED political correspondent Marisa Lagos. Marisa, California getting around $45 billion, most of any state, but less per person than in other less populous states. So thoughts on the money addressing critical problems like the port backlog?
I mean, I think it can only help, right? This isn't an overnight problem that can be fixed. But as you all noted, there's two ports here, Los Angeles and Long Beach, pretty much right next to each other, that are the two busiest container ports in the United States. And even before this bill passed, the president and others were promising to give resources to help operate those ports around the clock, 24/7. But this infrastructure money, they are trying to get out to ports like those within the next 90 days. They're going to allow flexibility around creating more storage on land, for example, to help move those goods. And I do think that there's hope that some of these sort of shorter term problems could help speed up that supply chain problem.
Yeah. What about roads, bridges? Are there those that are top priority?
All of them. We have over 1,500 bridges and over 14,000 miles of highway in poor condition here. And many of those projects are actually underway. So this will hopefully give state dollars a boost to get some of those done quicker and maybe expand the scope of them.
Okay. What about water projects or broadband? You spoke with Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, the Democrat who represents Silicon Valley.
We know there are parts of our community, even here in Santa Clara County, where high-speed internet does not exist. And you can go and find out where that is when you see parents with their kids in a car outside of McDonald's so their kids can do their homework. That should not be. And this will be a major step forward to end that.
We've seen those scenes across the country, but this can't be a fast fix.
No, but this is going to help. I mean, this is going to help both governments build out broadband access and private companies, but also something like a quarter of Californians who are low income will actually qualify for direct help. Also, water access. A million Californians in this rich state lack access to clean drinking water. Mm. We're expecting to see over $3.5 billion over 5 years to help connect those homes with safe water.
And what about in the minute we have money that might go to a bullet train line that's under construction or regular commuter lines, other public transportation?
Yeah, there is hope that this will help those, you know, local lines improve. And it may end up easing a political debate here over that bullet train, which has been very politically wrought. There's about $4 billion from a bond from a few years ago that the governor wants to use for the train. Hopefully, he's hoping this money will help offset that. And the infrastructure bill will put money towards those local commuter projects that lawmakers want to use that bond money for.
And then, if I may, California needs. Marisa Lagos, a political correspondent for KQED in California. Thank you.
My pleasure, Robin.
All right, let's move on to Missouri, which should get around $8 billion from the infrastructure bill, and most of that will help repair roads and bridges, but it's also causing some new cracks in state politics. St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum joins us now. Jason, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Congresswoman Cori Bush was one of six Democrats who voted against the infrastructure money. And when you spoke with her on Monday, she said she voted no because Democrats were promised a vote on a bigger social spending bill, which they haven't gotten yet. Let's listen.
I think that as elected officials, when we tell our communities that we're going to do something, we should carry out what we said. And it was the best choice. St. Louis deserves the president's entire agenda. So that means both the bipartisan infrastructure package and the Build Back Better Act.
Jason, is Cori Bush out of step with other politicians in Missouri who are feeling, sounds like, pretty good about this $8 billion in new infrastructure cash?
I think it depends on who you ask. I think that there are definitely voters, especially in the St. Louis area, who completely understand why Cori Bush voted the way she did, that the Democrats should have voted first on the Build Back Better bill, which provides money for things like child care and preschool and expanding the child tax credit and a lot of money for environmental matters. On the other hand, Missouri does have labor unions that are robust and powerful, and many of them were frankly disappointed that Congresswoman Bush did not vote along with the other Democratic congressman in the state, Emanuel Cleaver, for this bill. But from talking with Congresswoman Bush, she's hoping that what ended up happening on Friday, where you got the commitment of those moderate Democrats in the House to vote for the Build Back Better plan after the CBO score comes in, it could provide more momentum for that. We'll just have to wait and see.
Your Republican Senator Roy Blunt did vote for the infrastructure bill. He said he hopes that money goes to two large rail yards. Tell me about that and some of the other key projects in Missouri.
So when Senator Blunt was on KCUR, the Kansas City NPR affiliate, yesterday, or 2 days ago for that matter, he mentioned that St. Louis and Kansas City have two of the largest rail yards in the entire country. We also have some inland ports, especially in the St. Louis area, where the money from this infrastructure bill could go to modernize and spruce up both of those very important transportation economic engines. Missouri also just has a lot of roads. We have a lot of roads that bisect the state from St. Louis to Kansas City, as well as a lot of roads in rural parts of the state, which are critical for economic development there. People like Senator Blunt, who's a Republican, is hoping that this money is going to provide projects for all of those needs I just mentioned.
Those ports you're referring to, I assume, are related to the Mississippi River?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, the legislature just raised a gas tax as well this year, which means that you're going to have even more money for infrastructure projects. What kind of impact would they have together?
Well, just to give a sense to the listeners how vast Missouri's road needs are, when I was talking with Senate President Pro Tem Dave Schatz earlier this year after the gas tax passed, he mentioned that there's $10 billion in backlogs just for roads. And as you mentioned in the outset, the infrastructure bill only provides, and I say only, $8 billion is not an only. That's a lot of money for roads. But even that is not enough to deal with all the transportation needs, especially with roads in Missouri. So the gas tax will bring in about $500 million a year. You'll be able to get federal match with that. And we may have a situation where with the state acting and the federal government acting, the backlog of road projects may go down considerably.
All right. Jason Rosenbaum, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And lastly, North Carolina, which will see a nearly $9 billion infusion of infrastructure funding. WUNC politics reporter Rusty Jacobs is here. And Rusty, on Monday, North Carolina Congresswoman Deborah Ross, the Democrat, said the money will have a big impact over the next 5 years.
This historic legislation will help our people get to work and school, get products from our groundbreaking companies to markets across America and all around the globe.
So, Rusty, what are some of the specifics?
Looking at $400 million a year for highways, $90 million for bridges, $40 million for transit, everything from electric charging stations, zero-emissions buses, maybe some light rail, over $1 billion to improve water infrastructure that's helping rural counties, remote places without the tax base to pay for sewer upgrades, and, of course, $100 million for broadband access, again, reaching those remote parts of the state to expand internet access.
So what happens? You know, the state, like any state, could apply for grants as well for electric vehicle charging stations or money for public transportation improvements. But you mentioned broadband expansion. Is there going to be debate over which one gets it?
Not likely over the last thing you mentioned, broadband access. That's even been a point of bipartisanship for our Democratic governor and the Republican majority legislature. I think you'll also see a lot of interest in the money that's available for combating PFAS, these forever chemicals from companies like Chemours in North Carolina that leaked these pollutants into rivers for a long time until just being discovered a few years ago. And those chemicals go into making things like Teflon and other water-resistant projects. Mm-hmm. But I think money that people across the political spectrum want to see money for cleaning up that kind of pollution.
So consensus there, but the North Carolina congressional delegation was split along party lines on voting for this infrastructure money, as you all know. So what's the sense? Are Republicans who opposed it going to try to block money for projects or, you know, show up at groundbreaking and claim credit? What's the thinking?
I doubt they're going to aim or try to block any of this funding. I think what they want is in the 2022 midterms coming up, they want to be seen as having fought against a socialist agenda that spends recklessly. That's what one Congressman Patrick McHenry, a GOP Republican from North Carolina, called it, said it's progressive legislation that spends recklessly. I'll note that the split's not just between Republicans and Democrats in Congress. It's between Republicans in the House and Republicans in the Senate. North Carolina's two Republican senators, Tom Tillis and Richard Byrd, both voted for this. Tom Tillis called it a lifeline for Americans, but you got to note, Tom Tillis won re-election last year. He's not worried about anything for a few years. And Richard Byrd has said he's not going to run for re-election for a fourth term next year. So he's not worried so much either. I think that the Republicans that are worried the most are the ones that have to run next year and don't want to be seen as supporting a quote-unquote socialist agenda.
It will be interesting to see if things actually get done, if voters who are tooling along on a new highway think of it as the new socialist highway. You know, it'll be interesting to see. Rusty Jacobs, a politics reporter for WUNC in North Carolina, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I have a hard time making new friends. At one point, about a year into this pandemic, I realized it had been a very long time since I'd met anyone new. And even for me, someone who feels anxious around new people, that absence of connecting with strangers was a real loss. I know many of you have experienced something similar, even before the virus broke loose. Here's Ray Charlton, one of our listeners from Oregon. He's 65 years old.
As I get older, it just seems like it gets harder and harder to make friends or even want to make friends. It gets to be a lot of work putting myself out there.
We'll hear from more people like Ray in just a moment, but first, psychologist and professor at the University of Maryland, Marissa G. Franco. She's working on a book about making friends and new connections as an adult. Marissa, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
These connections are so important. In fact, you know, I'm in awe of my children who can pretty much go up to basically any kid at the playground and they just start playing. And in fact, my youngest daughter will call any child her age like her best friend.
Oh. You know,
like, it's amazing. But that isn't how I feel at all. What changes as we get older?
Yeah, so sociologists have kind of identified the ingredients that need to be in place for us to make friends organically. And they are continuous unplanned interaction and shared vulnerability. But as we become adults, we have less and less environments where those ingredients are at play. Friendship no longer happens organically. Like, you have to try. You have to put yourself out there. You have to be intentional. And that's actually one of the biggest myths that I think people have about friendship, is the idea that it should happen organically, even though research has shown us that people that see friendship as something that happens based on luck are more lonely years later, and those who see it as something that happens based on effort are less lonely years later.
Do you think that the sense is that it happens organically just because that's the way it used to happen when we were younger?
That's it, because it used to happen that way, and we're just using our template from childhood in adulthood when it just no longer applies because our situation is so different.
We asked our listeners to share their experiences with making friends as an adult, and we got a lot of responses. So we're going to go through some of them. And each of the people you're about to hear will be in different stages of their lives. So let's start with Juliana Clark. She's 25 years old and she lives in LA.
Sometimes I've been able to make a couple friends here and there. I'm really more interested in kind of creating like a sustainable community, especially since at least so many of the friendships that I've made in my life have kind of had these common experiences anchoring them.
So what's your advice for younger adults like Juliana who may no longer have the built-in social structure of college or any kind of school?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when I think about some background for this that I think would be helpful to inform her point, is that this concept of the mirror exposure effect, which according to the psychology research is the idea that as we see people more regularly and they become more familiar to us, we like them more. This happens completely unconsciously. So we need to basically create and structure that continuous unplanned interaction in our lives. And we can do that by just having something that we meet regularly around. Let's say we say, hey, do you want to meet and rotate potlucks, rotate dinners. It's all researchers also find that when we develop groups, our friendships are more sustainable than they are with individuals because there's multiple touch points now, right? Someone else in the group could reach out to all of us and then we all keep in touch.
I hear that. I do. It makes sense. But some people will be listening to you and it will scare the heck out of them to do something like that. You wrote something that I think could be really helpful for people who feel that way. And that is that we should just assume that people, even strangers that we're talking to or want to talk to, that they like us, that they actually do like us. How important is that?
Oh my gosh, it's so important. This one piece of advice that I've come across has just changed my life so much. We all have this tendency to think we're more likely to be rejected than we actually are. Huh. Making that your running dialogue, like, oh, it's really scary for me to ask my friend, but I'm going to assume that they might be interested in this. I'm going to assume that this might go well. I'm going to assume that they'd like to hang out just like I would. Is a really powerful way to sort of build up your confidence so that you can initiate. Also, more generally, just try your best to check your mean internal dialogue that we all have within us and to consider that other people might like you more than you think they do.
I think that's so helpful. Thank you for that. We also heard from a lot of people in their 30s and their 40s who said that having kids or moving to a new city made it tough for them to form connections. Here's Kate Hickok. She's 42, moved to Maine from New York City with her husband in 2018, and she tells us that they still haven't met any friends.
We have two small children. One was a baby when we moved here, and one was born during the pandemic, so it's hard to make plans. I'm also a city girl. I often feel like an outsider when trying to engage with those in my new local Maine community who either grew up here and have established connections, or those who moved here because of their love of nature and the outdoors. I thought I could force friendship to happen by attending events or participating in local sports or activities. I've definitely been angry at my lack of friendship and at our new hometown.
So Kate told us she thought that she could force friendships by participating in local events. And on the one hand, you know, she's trying. She's putting herself out there like we were talking about, but it's not working. So where do you think she might have gone wrong?
Yeah, well, first of all, I just want to say, Kate, I'm sorry it's been so hard, and it's so hard for so many of us. And it just takes time to make friends, and it's hard to be in that period where you're new and you don't know people, and maybe there's a new culture in the place you're in that isn't necessarily what you're used to. So I definitely think that you're not necessarily doing things wrong and that making friends is just inevitably hard. So I hope that you give yourself a lot of grace. For parents of small children, I don't know if there's a way that you can make friends with other parents of small children, but that often can make things easier because it's more acceptable to bring your small children and bring them all together. And sometimes they can entertain each other, maybe not the newborn. That will be less of a barrier if you find someone else who's in a similar circumstance. The other thing that I would say is, so Kate, what I hear from her response is that she's already overcome the phenomenon of overt avoidance. Overt avoidance means I am just going to avoid people. I'm not going to get out of my house. But the other thing you have to overcome is covert avoidance. Covert avoidance means you show up at the event, but you're checked out mentally. Mm. You're on your phone. You're waiting for people to come to you. You're not introducing yourself to people. It's not just that you have to attend that event, but you have to overcome covert avoidance by engaging with people when you get there. And then taking the opportunity to make the ask, right? Because it's not just showing up. It's more than that. And so if you find someone that you do like and that you do feel like you connect to, just saying like, oh, I'd actually love to like hang out again. I really enjoyed talking to you. Would you mind exchanging contact information? That's really, really key to take it from, hey, I'm putting myself out there, to we're actually going to form a connection and begin to form a friendship.
Look, there's also a number of people who find themselves more and more isolated as they get older. David Troxell, we heard from. He's 64, never got married, never had children, and he says that he's been socially disconnected for the last 10 years or more.
I find that typically the people have all or most of the social connections that they can manage. I met somebody several years ago that I thought I might get to be friends with and invited them out to have coffee with me. And over coffee, I was told that this person really had all the friends that they need.
You know, I feel for every person who called in for us. I especially feel for David because I think that it can be hard for men, especially as they get older, to branch out and to be vulnerable enough to make connections with other people.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad you bring up that men piece. Like, as I've studied for this book, my world has been blown by how gender tends to determine our social worlds. Just with men, there's this phenomenon called homo hysteria, which is the fear of being perceived as gay, that I think really, really is destructive for men's friendships. Like, I've heard men tell me, I'm not even comfortable reaching out and saying, you know, let's meet up for a drink because I feel like it'll come off like I'm coming on to him. And so there's just so many behaviors that are necessary for friendship, but homo hysteria has equated those behaviors to sexual interest when absolutely not. Like, all of these things are central for platonic connections. And specifically for men, we know from the research that they tend to rely more on their romantic partners for social interaction, whereas women tend to keep a larger network in play. But I just wanted to point out that when you're lonely, people don't realize loneliness isn't just a feeling. It actually fundamentally alters how you see the world. If you are in a place of loneliness, you are, according to the research, more likely to assume people are going to reject you. You're just sort of hyper-vigilant for rejection and social threats. You're more likely to think that social interactions will be more negative and less enjoyable. It's why loneliness actually ends up being self-perpetuating, and the most effective interventions for loneliness have actually focused on changing people's thoughts, changing how they see the social world, more so than connecting them with people, because of this really difficult and grisly mindset that we tend to take on when we're more lonely. And so that's just some of the things that I would suggest for this caller is, like, to try to be a little bit more optimistic. You had this one negative experience. It had sucked. Someone said they had too many friends, right? But that certainly doesn't mean that everybody has too many friends. And that certainly doesn't mean that there aren't people out there that are just waiting for you to connect with them. And so I just want to remind this caller that the world may be more open to them than they think they are, than they think it is, and that there may be a lot more people that want to be their friend that they might not see because of some of the real and difficult experiences that they've been through.
The good news is that what you've told us here today is that you can do it. You can make new friends. You got to put in the effort, but remember, people like you. They really do. Marissa G. Franco is a psychologist and friendship expert and a professor at the University of Maryland. Thank you so much for your time.
It was my pleasure.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
It has been a dramatic day of testimony in the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse. He's the 18-year-old who killed two people and wounded another during the unrest in Kenosha, Wisconsin last summer after the police shooting of Jacob Blake. Rittenhouse has claimed self-defense, and today he took the stand to make his case. Rittenhouse cried as he described the moments leading up to the shooting. He said he felt cornered by protesters.
There were three people right there.
Mayon Silver is covering the trial for WUWM in Milwaukee. And Mayon, that was really quite a moment on the stand today. How did that go over? And what else did we hear Kyle Rittenhouse say?
Yes, Peter, there had been some witnesses to Rittenhouse's shootings in the state's case, but that was really the first time jurors got a chance to hear directly from Kyle Rittenhouse. As you can hear, he got emotional when he described the first man who he shot, Joseph Rosenbaum, who he says chased after him. The judge had to call a recess at that point, and as the jury was leaving the courtroom, the pool reporter in the courtroom said many jurors were looking at him in apparent sympathy and that his mom was also sobbing as well within earshot of jurors. When he began testifying again, he described Rosenbaum chasing him into an enclosed area in a car lot, and he said he had no space to run away and that Rosenbaum lunged at him and had his hand on the barrel of the gun, and that's when he shot. And actually, he said a similar thing about the additional shootings that happened moments later, saying that the second man he shot came after him with a skateboard. And he said he could feel him pulling Rittenhouse's gun away with his strap coming off his body. And that's when he shot the second man and killed him.
Certainly dramatic testimony. But the prosecution also got a chance to cross-examine Rittenhouse. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Everybody that you shot at that night, you intended to kill, correct?
I didn't intend to kill them. I intended to stop the people who were attacking me.
By killing them?
I did what I had to do to stop the person who was attacking me.
By killing them?
Two of them passed away, but I stopped the threat from attacking me.
So what was the case that the prosecution was making when it was questioning Rittenhouse?
Yeah, so here the prosecution has charged Rittenhouse with multiple felonies, including first-degree intentional homicide. And here, District Attorney Thomas Binger was trying to get Rittenhouse, or getting Rittenhouse, to admit that he shot to kill. But of course, that's privileged under Wisconsin law. If Rittenhouse was using deadly force and he believed he was under attack, deadly force was necessary to stop the attack, and that the jury finds his beliefs were reasonable. So there was kind of the back and forth there of Rittenhouse trying to make his point that he killed, but it was under self-defense. The prosecution also focused on Rittenhouse's decision to possess an AR-15 underage and go to the unrest in Kenosha, and hasn't yet asked Rittenhouse about the shooting events themselves.
Well, at one point, the judge even admonished the prosecution several times during the cross-examination. The defense was threatening to move for a mistrial. So this was a big day in court today. What's next?
Yeah, this was a big day in court. The prosecution was chastised by the judge twice, and one time for even in what the judge said infringing on his right to pretrial silence and his decision when to testify. What's next in the trial is basically additional cross-examination of Rittenhouse. The defense can bring other witnesses. When the defense rests, there could be rebuttal witnesses from the state and eventually closing arguments. The state, in this case, has the burden of disproving self-defense beyond a reasonable
doubt. Mayan Silver, thank you so much. WUWM in Milwaukee.
It's Phoenix, you know. It's supposed to be hot. You can't get around God's plan, you know.
This is my fellow Phoenician, Mario Moreno, who knows the heat as well as anyone. I found him doing yard work last month in front of his South Phoenix home, wearing a tank top and sweating under the late October sun.
I've been living in this house for 45 years.
Have you noticed the heat get any worse, though? I mean, because it has gotten hotter.
Well, you know, it stays hotter for longer.
Longtime residents like Moreno and me often dismiss the heat as a normal part of life in the desert. But lately, it has been really, really hot. Temperatures soared past 100 degrees on 145 different days last year. That was a record. A record number of people also died in that heat. So with the world's attention on the climate conference in Scotland, I wanted to see what the stakes were like closer to home, literally at the street level. The road outside Moreno's house was recently repaved with a cooler, more reflective surface. The blacktop is now gray.
I don't think this is enough to make a difference.
A bandit.
Yeah. You know, it's a bandit on a broken leg. There's so much asphalt, so much building. They plowed under all the cotton fields, the alfalfa fields, and people are moving in here. Well, the heat's going to go up.
The city believes these roads might help. They're being tested in a few neighborhoods, and the surface is 10 to 12 degrees cooler than traditional asphalt. It's part of a much bigger plan to adapt to an even hotter future. And this is the person in charge of pulling it off.
We could wind up with a city of the future that is cooler than the one we have today, even as the entire planet warms.
Dave Hondula was just hired as the city's first ever heat mitigation officer, a sign of how serious the problem has become. Hondula says the idea is to rethink the way Phoenix is built, make rooftops and roads more reflective, build shade structures, and plant thousands and thousands of new trees every year.
We have a lot of reason to be optimistic if deployment can happen at large scale.
The task is immense. Daytime temperatures have gone up a few degrees since 1950, when the population started booming. But Hondula says the real problem is at night. All the asphalt and concrete in the sprawling city hang on to the heat long after the sun goes down. The effect is known as the urban heat island. Hondula told me about it not far from Mario Moreno's front yard.
Depending on when we go back in the record, we're talking about a 7, 8, 9 degree Fahrenheit increase in average summer nighttime temperatures. And that's what residents tell us they really feel. They notice as they're out in their communities. If we find anybody who's lived in the Phoenix area for any length of time, they'll tell us, I remember how much cooler the nights used to be.
Well, in fact, I grew up in this city. You're right, it's always been hot. But if you look at recent years, I think it was last year, 110 degrees, 53 days last summer. Which, that's remarkable. That's historic.
Yeah, last year, summer 2020, was a glimpse into the future. What we saw in 2020 is expected to come our way. Exactly when? Will it be 2040, 2050, 2070, 2080? That depends on decisions that will be made at the COP meeting and in other global climate negotiations, as well as what we do here locally with respect to urbanization. But 2020 shows us the type of weather we need to be prepared for.
What are the projections? Can you get specific at all?
On the low end, we're looking at 3-4 degrees Fahrenheit warmer by the end of the century. At the high end of that scenario, our hottest days, the days that are 115 right now, 116, those could be 8, 9, 10 degrees Fahrenheit hotter.
The context there is that it's incredibly dangerous for the heat to get that high. How would you describe the danger of that heat in this city?
We know all across the United States, heat is either the deadliest or second deadliest weather-related hazard. Here in Maricopa County, unfortunately, in each of the last 5 years, we've set records for the number of people that have died from heat, outpacing population growth. The risk of heat-related death increases almost exponentially as a function of temperature. A day that's 10 degrees hotter isn't just a little bit more dangerous, it's a lot more dangerous.
When you watched those records recently, the heat death records, how alarming was that for you as someone who watches this?
It has been quite alarming. When we set records before 2020, we were setting them by a very marginal amount, maybe 1/10 of a degree hotter for the June summer temperature. And that shouldn't lead to an increase in heat-related deaths by the margins we were seeing. So what shocked us was we look at the weather records and we wouldn't expect there to be any or many more heat-related deaths than there were in previous years, but we see those numbers moving up, which tells us that there are other pieces to the story. In 2020, of course, we had the intersection with COVID, and it was really hot, so not as surprised to see the numbers really spike in 2020. But I think the same story is true, that had we done a better job with basic social service programs in 2020, those numbers could have been kept down, even with the heat.
Now, there's a reason, we just heard a car go by, there's a reason that we're standing on this street in South Phoenix, because you're trying to get at some of the solutions to this problem. Tell me about this neighborhood where we are now, because I understand that it's hotter here even than in other places across the city.
We're in the neighborhood that might be called the Lindo Park, Rosalie Park neighborhood in South Phoenix. And most importantly, why we're here, this is a neighborhood where residents have come together to tell the city, to tell the county health department that they're looking for more when it comes to keeping the neighborhood cool.
Because they know it's a problem.
They know it's a problem. We don't need a PhD to come in and tell residents here that it's hot and the heat is a challenge in their life. They're the expert. We also do know, when we look at, for example, satellite measurements of the ground temperature, in this part of the city, those ground temperatures are higher than in other places.
So let's talk about why that might be. I mean, we know across the southwestern United States that some neighborhoods are just hotter than others. They're often, or almost always, poorer neighborhoods. One of the reasons why is because there's not as much tree cover. Now, we're standing in shade right now, but I guess that's a rarity in this neighborhood.
Yeah, we're enjoying some very nice shade at the moment, in fact. But as we look up and down this particular street that we're on, there are very few places where we could be standing. As we look, you know, probably a quarter mile to our west and a quarter mile to our east, we've kind of found the one spot where we could be standing in the shade comfortably on this late October day.
Exactly. I think that's an important point. It's almost November. We need the shade to be comfortable.
Absolutely. What we'd also notice if we left, so we're on a residential street right now, but if we moved out to one of our major arterial streets, we would see tree canopy really go down. And if we looked for places to plant trees, we'd start to scratch our head a bit. And infrastructure constraints are a real obstacle that we're going to need to invest serious money in overcoming if we want to increase tree canopy in all parts of the city.
What do you mean? I mean, is that because there's just too much asphalt around here? There's no dirt to put the trees in?
Yeah, if we were to walk a couple streets over, we'd find a storefront that's really close to the front of its lot, immediately up against the sidewalk, which is immediately up against the street. There's no mulch bed, there's no median in the street, there are no opportunities where the city would own the land to be able to plant trees there. The physical space is not there for tree planting in a lot of parts of the city. That unfortunately, are those parts of the city that could benefit from it the most.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I'm realizing as I talk to you is that these solutions are really mitigation. They're not solving the core problem, which is carbon emissions warming the atmosphere, which are making this desert city more and more inhospitable. As someone who spends so much of their time thinking about this, what keeps you up at night as you consider the job ahead?
I mean, first and foremost, we have a lot of people who are suffering the worst possible outcome from heat right now. 191 heat-related deaths in Phoenix in 2020. Numbers are still being tabulated for 2021. We need to find ways to get those people out of harm's way now. I appreciate the importance of the global conversation around emissions, but we've got hundreds of people who we need to put a water bottle in their hands, get them into shelter, be sure that their air conditioning gets repaired in a timely manner. We're not doing as good of a job with that right now as we could be, and the numbers have been moving in the wrong direction. And then the other side of the story is thinking about the scale of investment that will be required to cool the city. We're going to need a lot of trees. We're going to need a lot of strategies like cool pavement to be deployed. The city has made a larger budget commitment than it previously has to these topics. But if we're serious about large-scale deployment, that's going to call for many more resources than we've planned for.
But where will those resources come from? And is there enough time to solve a problem that is already showing signs of boiling over? My children live in this city, and I often wonder about their future here, if there will come a time when living in Phoenix just becomes impossible. Think about it. Where would you go if the heat keeps soaring and the water runs dry?
In parts of the country, it's apple season, whether you pick your own or go to the farmer's market or the store. Here now, resident chef Kathy Gunst has almost our annual list of recipes for you. Hi, Kathy.
Hello, Robin.
So let's review. So many different kinds of apples. They come in at different times. What are some of your favorites?
Oh, there's so many. Apparently, there's 2,500 different varieties of apples. A few of my absolute favorites are ginger gold, this cream-colored flesh with this mild tart flavor. I love Jana golds. I adore an apple called Mutsu. They have such wonderful names. They're also called Crispin, and they're sweet, and they're almost a little spicy. There's, you know, very few apples I don't like when they're fresh and in season like they are now.
I don't like mushy. That's the only kind
no.
I don't like.
Yeah.
Crisp.
Nobody likes mushy.
Right. Start with a recipe for a breakfast sandwich.
Yeah, and let's use the word breakfast loosely. I mean, this is a sandwich that has eggs and bacon and lettuce in it. But what it also has are beautiful slices of sautéed apples. You take your favorite type of apple, make thick slices, and you sauté it with some apple cider and maple syrup. Mm-hmm. And when it's just tender, you take it out of the skillet with a slotted spoon, because what you're going to do is keep boiling that maple syrup and cider until it becomes this thick, almost gooey glaze. You let it cool down, and then you mix it into mayonnaise. And that is spread on beautiful toast or an English muffin, a bagel, anything you want, layered with a fried egg, crisp bacon, or take the bacon off if you don't do that. Mm-hmm. But the sautéed apple and the apple cider maple syrup mayonnaise puts this breakfast, lunch, or dinner sandwich over the top.
Oh, man. And this is, of course, after you've run 20 miles in the morning that you have this.
Goes without saying.
Look, I have a question for you, because I love to put sliced apples in things. Let's say you're grilling sandwiches, or, you know, grilled cheese or tuna.
Yes.
And I put some slices of apples. But I never thought of sautéing them first.
Yeah, I mean, what happens is that they get almost buttery and tender, and a lot of the nuance of the flavor of the apple emerges in a way you might not taste with a raw apple slice. Also be fun to try it with sautéed and raw slices for that textural difference and just the way the apple flavors shine through.
Okay, now you have a salad, apples and salad, great. Waldorf salad, apples, you know, walnuts and stuff, but your salad has apples, cabbage, and kale?
Yes, it's really a wonderful salad. In fact, I've had it 3 times this week. I just find myself craving it. Thinly sliced red cabbage, fresh kale leaves, very coarsely chopped, and then apples, peeled, cored, and cut into matchsticks. You give them a little bit of lemon juice and salt, which kind of marinates the kale and the cabbage and softens it. And then in the meantime, you glaze walnut halves in olive oil or butter with some maple syrup so it gets this great caramelized, gooey nut. And you sprinkle those on top, and then you add fresh sage and Dijon mustard and olive oil to make the dressing. Very simple, perfect for this time of year. I actually think it would be a wonderful Thanksgiving salad because it really breaks up the richness of all the foods that are about to come upon us.
Right, right. And it's got fiber and crunchiness and all that. We'll have all these recipes, by the way, at herenow.org. But staying with salads for just a second, am I fooling myself? But I thought I was told once, and so I do this, that if you squeeze a lemon over the apple that you've cut up for salad, it'll maintain the white look of the apple. It won't go yellow.
This is factual. You are not fooling yourself. Okay. Whenever I'm preparing apples for sweet or savory dish, if you want to prepare them and you're not quite ready to use them, just squeeze a teaspoon of fresh lemon juice on it and give it a toss, and it will stop the oxidation and it will keep it from turning brown.
Okay. We can't forget dessert. Everybody's got their own apple pie recipe, but you've got a sweet apple recipe that could be used as a substitute. What's that?
This is a cake that I have fallen in love with. It's a spiced apple bundt cake. You use nutmeg, ginger, and cinnamon with 4 tart apples. It's got eggs and apple cider in it, a little bit of vanilla. This is a cake that will not take you very long and would be beautiful for breakfast with a strong cup of coffee, an afternoon treat, or really at a holiday table. Just a very simple seasonal cake. But it's those spices mixed with the apples that just wonderful cake. I'm kind of obsessed with it.
Maybe with ice cream. I don't know. I'm just saying. But and just quick tip on storage.
Refrigeration, it turns out, is the answer here. Apples have a gas that causes them to ripen fast. You want to keep them away from avocados and bananas and melons. And the cool temperature and the darkness of a refrigerator actually slows that down. Also, shopping, look for apples that are really firm to the touch. That's where you're going to get a crisp apple. And it may sound crazy, but smell it, because the wonderful variety of odors of apples do come through when they're raw, and avoid bruises in all things.
Yes. Here Now resident chef Kathy Gunst will have all of the recipes at herenow.org. Kathy, thank you as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now.